Hi, this is Jerry Slezak from the Division of Teaching and Learning Technologies at the University of Mary Washington. Coming up next, the keynote address from the 2006 Faculty Academy on Instructional Technologies, 21st Century Literacy, featuring author, editor, and Web 2.0 developer John Udell of InfoWorld Magazine.
Welcome to the keynote address for Faculty Academy 2006. I would like to... Yes, thank you. A whoop of delight is always appreciated. Yay! I'd like to thank our sponsors, Verizon and Bell Technologies, Sun Microsystems, for helping to make this Faculty Academy possible and also helping to sponsor our keynote talk this morning. I'd also like to say that time management is not only difficult with technology, it's difficult with presenters as well. We've gone very smoothly, I think, but yesterday there was one particular presenter I felt very bad about because he didn't get the time to speak that he had hoped for. So I'm going to try to make it up to John Pierce today by asking you all, in your spare time, during the break or whatever, if you can head downstairs and see the Real Space exhibit for the Centennial Project that John Pierce and his class in historic preservation put together. I think you'll find some stuff that's well worth looking at and very inspiring. I draw your attention particularly to the big thank you over on the wall, since it demonstrates a partnership among many different departments here at the university that I think is quite exemplary. So I urge you, if you get a chance, go downstairs, just one floor, take a look at the exhibit, and let John know how much you appreciate that. Now for another John, but he spells it without an H. This is John Udell. What are the facts about John Udell? He is currently lead analyst and blogger-in-chief for the InfoWorld Test Center. He's an author, he's an editor, he's a prolific developer. He was, I'm happy to say, a prize-winning essayist as an undergraduate English major at the University of Michigan. So there is life after a BA. What do you do with a BA in English? I don't know. Whatever you want, right? But here's the John Udell story I'd like to share with you. Walt Disney coined the term Imagineer. I'd like to appropriate that term, take it away from the Magic Kingdom, and apply it to John Udell. The work he is doing to try to bridge the world of the folks who are writing the code, the folks who are keeping the computers running, and those of us who are out here trying to figure out what can you do with these technologies anyway, is exemplary. I found John Udell by way of one of our instructional technology specialists, Jerry Slezak, who one day at lunch said, "Have you seen this article on heavy metal umlaut bands?" I said, "No, I can't say that I've run across that one. Can you explain it to me?" He said, "No." "You'll just have to go to the website and see it for yourself," which I did. How could you resist? And what I found there was an extraordinary piece of communication, analysis, and imagineering as John Udell took us on a tour not just of heavy metal umlaut bands, but the way Wikipedia exemplifies certain processes basic to civilization. What happens when we think together over time to construct understanding? It took my breath away. So immediately I went back and read all of John Udell I could find. We talk about John in our staff meetings constantly. He's our guru in residence, though I don't know that you feel those vibrations all the way up in New Hampshire. There you go. And it was a tremendous rush for all of us when we invited John to come be our keynote speaker, and he said yes, cutting short a trip in New York for a conference there to come down for the day and to join us. I think you'll find what he has to say not only challenging and informative, but tremendously inspiring. It's my great pleasure to welcome John Udell.
Thanks very much. It, believe me, is a treat to be here doing this instead of another day of enterprise IT. Just to frame this, here are a couple of people that have been kind of landmarks for me. This guy, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, was a Jesuit priest and a paleontologist who wrote a book, most famously, I think, The Phenomenon of Man, which I read as an undergrad long before there was an internet in something like the mid-1970s. He actually made it into Wired magazine because he sort of intuited what we call the blogosphere. Now, he had a different word for it. He called it the noosphere. And it was this notion, though, of really planetary consciousness. I was much taken by that. However, he had a pretty mystical idea of what that was. This guy over here on the right, Doug Engelbart, actually not too much longer after that, had sort of the concrete vision. So Engelbart, many people know as the inventor of the mouse, and some people know as the pioneer of a lot of the paradigms of the graphical user interface, and also the guy who, what you see here is this famous demonstration that he gave in, I think, 1968. You can find the video of this online, and it's worth a watch. It's pretty much the complete vision of Skype and remote telepresence and hypertext, and he had all this stuff working. I mean, this wasn't just a concept. He actually built this stuff. So, Doug's, he's not going to be with us too much longer, but I had a chance to meet him. I know you did. The thing about Engelbart that I didn't understand until I actually listened to this talk, which you can find on IT Conversations. He was at Accelerating Change, I think, 2 years ago, and he gave a talk. And it was only then that I understood what really his mission was, which is, that all this geek stuff for him was just a means to an end. And the end was that after training as an engineer, in something like his mid-20s, he had a kind of a revelation about what he was here to do on this planet. And the revelation was that these technologies of collaboration and these ways of enabling people to sort of join their minds together in electronically mediated environments was, in fact, the way forward for the species, right? That we face critical challenges as a species, and that, only by putting our heads together literally in these electronically mediated ways are we going to be able to come up with the solutions to our problems. And so, he has actually, to this day, got an extreme sense of urgency about what all this stuff is for. And so I just realized that, actually. I didn't know. Anyway, so a set of topics here that I've been just rearranging over the last few months to help me kind of organize my thoughts. I'll just list them here. So I have a topic called Heads, Decks, and Leads, which is about sort of the importance of titles and topic sentences and things like that. A few thoughts on the importance of naming. A concept called active lists, or actually I keep changing the name of this, but I'll illustrate all of these things by example because I'm a very concrete thinker, actually. An idea called data literacy and meme hacking. We'll talk about meme hacking, and we'll talk about storytelling in the multimedia realm. And finally, we'll talk about this notion I have of what blogging is from a sort of professional perspective. So there are a bunch of things that either we did learn or should have learned in grade school that turned out to be as important as they ever were, and in some ways more important or differently important in a world of electronic publications. I've spent a lot of time in e-publishing, so I think a lot about this stuff. So one of the things I've observed that we often overlook is this basic idea of, in the newspaper business, we call it heads, decks, and leads. In other contexts, it's subjects and topic sentences and titles and things like that. And this stuff is always incredibly important because it really, it was information architecture before there was a notion of that as a discipline. But it is, in fact, a kind of engineering. It is the engineering of information to layer it in such ways that it's accessible to people in ways that they need it to be. So one of the things I notice is that here, for example, we have somebody who's written a web blog entry, and it has a nice title, which is memorable, and that's great. And here it is being displayed in the blog entry, here it is in the newsreader. So everything looks fine, right? He's written a good title, and we can see it. We can decide whether or not to read this blog entry based on the title that shows up in the newsreader. But when you search Google in such a way as to cause that blog entry to be the first item, what you see is that the title that shows up here is not the title that the guy wrote. And the reason for that is that there are actually two titles on a web page, right? There's the title that you would choose to write in the text of the page, and then there's the title which is in the metadata, if you will, in the head, the document head section. That's the thing that shows up in Google. And so it's actually quite common to find blog pages that, when they show up in Google, have the title of the blog as the most prominent link shown in the search page, as opposed to the title of the entry. So, you know, kind of part of the lesson here is that an aspect of digital literacy is understanding the various contexts in which the stuff that you produce is going to be seen and experienced by other people. So in this case, the context of search results is a problem for a page that's written this way. And this was actually true on our own site as well. So all of the InfoWorld and, in fact, all of the IDG websites had this kind of a result in InfoWorld or in Google. You know, it doesn't matter. All search engines work the same way from this perspective. So in this context, you couldn't see anything about, you know, what was the age of this article? What, you know, who wrote it? What was the type? You know, was it a news story or, right? There's no information presented to enable anyone to make a decision. And that becomes critically important in this increasingly cluttered environment, right? It's never just enough. I mean, you hope it's enough to get people to the search results page, but then, you know, you have a fraction of a second to capture someone's attention, and the notion of clicking down on the next level is actually, you know, that's expensive. I mean, you think, well, it's just a click, but clicks are actually expensive, right? It's a disruption of context, and it's an effort to change gears and go into another space. So you want to be able, and this is just classic, you know, information layering, like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal understand how to do, right? We just don't think about it as effectively in the online space often. So the first thing we did was we just told our content management system to put out titles for the pages that incorporated various pieces of information. So, you know, why not say that it's InfoWorld? Why not say that it's a news story? Why not say that, you know, it was by so-and-so? Why not put the date as well as the title? So, you know, right there, that gives you a much more scannable result. And it works exactly the same way in Google, which is quite interesting, right? So, I mean, this is, you know, I've done a lot of search makeovers over time, and one of the things that people always trip over is, well, you know, what search engine did you use? As if it's, you know, some sort of magical thing that you buy the right search engine and you get these magical results. And the truth is, at this level, it doesn't matter. You can use any search engine because they all return URLs and they all return document titles. And so the thing is, you know, just think about writing your title. You know, just go back to the basics and do the right thing and use common sense, and you'll have all these wonderful effects that spin out of it. So, you know, this was a good start. And then, I was able to take this result, right, which is the UltraSeek engine that's running on the InfoWorld site, and unmodified what's coming out. Well, I did modify, but I took those results and I turned it into this application. So this is now the what will be the new version of search on the InfoWorld site, and it's only all the same stuff. But because I had a regular structure in the titles, now I'm able to organize the results by author, by date. I'm able to combine the results with the tags that come out of the Delicious service, and this is really my favorite part. I'm combining the heads, decks, and leads from the stories with the search results. Because if you think about it, I mean, what would UltraSeek have shown me if I were searching for the word Yukon? It would have found me the word Yukon with, you know, eight words in front of it and eight words in back of it, in the middle of some random paragraph. Well, is that the most useful thing to present at this level when someone is trying to decide if they want to drill down and read more about this? Well, I think actually if there was an editor who wrote a subhead and somebody thought about the lead paragraph, then those would be the most valuable things to present in this context. So do it, right? And, you know, it actually amazes me that essentially no search works this way, right? And so it's something to think about. It's really more about common sense and basic principles than it is about high tech. Another point on titles, and this is just something that endlessly frustrates me, but this is a sort of a typical discussion, a view of a discussion page, right, at the index level. So, you know, what you invariably see is some long thread, and this is the information that is available to me at this level to evaluate whether or not I want to go in and read these messages. Well, this is just tragic, right? I mean, these subject headings are the titles, right? And everyone who made a contribution to this discussion presumably had something to contribute. Therefore, you know, if you asked that person, you know, they presumably would have been able to describe what the contribution was in some succinct way. They would have had a title for what they were contributing, right? But we, you know, just mechanically have lost the ability to do this. And so, you know, imagine if just scanning the index page of a discussion thread, you could in fact absorb the entire sense of the discussion, right? I mean, the, you know, speed enhancement, I hope. How much faster? I don't know. More improvements coming. Try this, you know, and you can, you actually don't need to read the whole thing. I mean, if you are closely involved in this, you will read it. But the point is, you understand what's happening here. Now, you know, why don't we have this? It's just a train wreck, basically, in the way that technology is involved. I won't go into it in great detail, but just to sort of show you the issue here, this is me in Gmail responding to a message. And basically what I'd like to do is respond to the message and say something like, thanks, you know, or okay, or, you know, I want to communicate information in the title of the message as I respond, right? Because I don't really want this person to have to read, you know, open up and read an attachment just for me to okay what he said to me. So the issue, though, is it's in Gmail, for example, not even obvious that you can do that, right? The subject line is actually hidden. And if you want to change it, you have to do something kind of secret, right? And so no one will. And if they did, what they would find out is that it actually broke the threading, right? So that's actually why people don't do this. But, you know, I guess my point here is that in a lot of ways, we are allowing the technology to subvert, you know, what ought to be the proper uses of these things. And, you know, people should trust their instincts, right? You know, if you have the instinct that, you know, I should be able to write a title on a message because that's important, right? You know, but, oh, the software doesn't support it. Well, then you should make some noise about that, right? Because it's not, you know, I mean, it, you know, the only reason we have this is because we've allowed it to happen. So we have to trust our instincts and demand, you know, demand things go the way we want them to, because that's how changes will happen. So, in all areas, naming is a kind of profound thing, right? The World Wide Web Consortium has this catchphrase, cool URIs, URIs being URLs. That's just their geeky way of saying URL, which is a geeky way of saying, you know, whatever. Don't change, right? The idea being you put a URL out there and it's supposed to be persistent, right? So that things that are connected to it will remain connected to it. And so, probably when I started my library lookup project, I should have said, you know, library lookup instead of, you know, right? But I got it wrong, and, you know, whatever. You know, so you can't always get it right, but you know, this is why it matters, right? And in a number of different contexts. Because in this loosely coupled world of blogs that refer to other blogs, you know, and commentary on things, what threads things together are common URLs, you know, or in other areas, common identifiers. For example, the ISBN, you know, is a classic example of this. You know, there are lots of services, including some that I've created, that do lookups into library catalogs based on ISBNs. Problem being, though, that ISBNs are actually non-unique, right? There's a, for example, I mean, if this is the ISBN of a paperback edition of a book on my Amazon wish list, but this is the ISBN of the same book in hardcover, you know, then, you know, I'm not going to be able to look it up directly, right? There's a service out there now that I have incorporated into my library lookup service that will sort of map from one to many, right? So you said, you know, if this is, give me the ISBN of either the paperback or the hardcover, and I'll get back all of them, right? But, you know, in general, where possible, it turns out to be really important to think about the situations in which you're creating some online resource that you want other things to attach to and to be reliably attached to over time. And so, you know, there just are lots of opportunities, again, and for the technology to subvert that, right? There are lots of ways in which content management systems will allow you to create multiple addresses for the same page, for example. And, you know, then if you think about it, well, you know, how does Technorati know who's referring to this article if half of the people referred to it through this one and half of the people referred to it to that one, right? So, you know, there's, you know, part of the answer will be that we'll be looking for services like ISBN that say, you know, for anything that's this, it could also be that, right? You know, mapping services, and that those will exist. But it's also as a producer, you know, a really good idea to try to keep things as unique and durable as you can. A variation on this theme that I've been working on is this idea of assigning names to fragments of media. So, you know, we have obviously got all of this podcasting and screencasting and vlogging and other kinds of activities going on. And a big problem for it is that these are opaque media, right? So, you know, it's sort of like, here's the pointer to this hour of audio. You know, so now what do I do, right? You know, if you really what you want to draw attention to or have a conversation about is, you know, the thing that so-and-so said to so-and-so at minute 23, right? So, you know, I've for whatever reason thought a lot about this problem. You know, my solution to it right now is something like this. I say to somebody, check out the interview with so-and-so at IT Conversations, and you know, the response is, I don't have a half an hour to plow through that, right? And so my response is URL, right? And in this case, the URL is identifying the location within the stream, right? It's, you know, it's minute 10:02 to 13:50. That's the part I want you to hear, right? And in theory, the link that identifies that fragment is then itself potentially the locus of a discussion, right? So comments about that segment of the audio could be attracted to that URL as opposed to the general URL, which identifies the whole program, right? So you have a way of segregating discussion. This is it's probably a longer discussion than we have time for, but it, you know, this was always possible, is still possible in real audio. But no one ever exploited that capability. I mean, it's actually the case now that you can go, although nobody knows it, if you go to any of the C-SPAN stuff, audio or video, that, you know, for any of the C-SPAN broadcasts are such that you can form a URL, you know, using a syntax like this that says, I want to identify, you know, this 5-minute thing that the senator said, right? And point other people to it so you can have a conversation about it. It's never been discovered by essentially anyone, right? But in any case, you know, I mean, real is not the thing now. There's much more interest, legitimately, in podcasting in the sense of posting MP3 files, because it's a much more democratic process. Anyone can post an MP3 file pretty much. So, you know, I've been looking for ways to allow that same granular, or what's the word, the same precise addressing capability in just a file that was posted. So this is possible in IT Conversations, you know, but it's one of those things that I haven't sort of gotten to critical mass with this idea yet. So I just, you know, but I like to mention it because I think it's something, again, you know, people should, you know, if we're going to be working with audio and video as source materials in the same way that we work as text, with text as a source material, you know, and then we need the ability to identify fragments, and we need to be able to quote, we need to be able to attribute in precise ways. So it's something we should demand. This is illustrating a couple of things, and so what this is a service called Delicious, which is one of a class of services that are variously described as social bookmarking or social, I guess that's the term, social bookmarking, basically. And what it is you, instead of collecting bookmarks in your browser, saving them locally on your hard disk, you have a place on the network where your bookmarks go. You know, originally it was entirely bookmarks that you intended to share publicly. Recently, now you can also make them private if you want to, so you can make a separation between those two things. But so what I'm doing here is, you know, just as a matter of course, when I listen to a ton of audio these days, you know, the podcasting revolution has been very good to me because the area that I work in is one in which much of the conference material is being posted as MP3 files. And so it's actually extraordinary because you never really want, you're always torn at conferences between trying to absorb the presentations and do all the actual interaction. That's the real good reason to be there. So in fact now there are two presentations going on at the same time. Anyway, I get lots of this stuff now through my headphones just while I'm out running or riding my bicycle. And so that actually means there's conferences I feel that I've attended even though I haven't gone to, right? And there's ones where even though I did go there, I was able to focus on the interaction and absorb the sort of static material, or not static, but the prepared material, kind of out of band. And that's also better for me because I actually can't absorb like 8 hours straight of talks, right? So I'd rather trickle it in over a period of time. Anyway, as I go through the stuff, something usually sticks in my mind. So if I listen to an hour show, there's usually a soundbite or two that stick with me. And what I've done here is I've made a little an area in my bookmark site for soundbites. And so these are all URLs of the form that I showed you, right? So it's a pointer to an MP3 file at the IT Conversation site or somewhere else, which is an hour lecture, right? But my pointer to that thing is identifying, I've invested an hour in listening to this thing. If you don't have an hour, but you'd like to know what I thought was interesting, follow this link and listen to 2 minutes or 3 minutes worth of it. I get a lot of questions like this, and I'm sure everyone does, basically, what do you know about X, right? And nowadays, here's how I answer those questions. I answer them with URLs, and those URLs identify topics within this social bookmarking service where I have been accumulating resources, links. The difference here is that in the first case, so I have a topic called intermediation, and the URL judel/intermediation in Delicious pulls up everything in that bucket. But you can do a kind of a database query by combining these tags, is what they're called. These keywords are called tags. So the convention that I use is if it was posted from my blog, then I'm also going to append my name as a tag. So in other words, if I want to find the things that I wrote on that topic, I will use the tag intermediation plus John Udell. And that's the subset of items posted to the J. Udell account under the tag intermediation, which were written by me. Is that clear? Okay. This has been a profound change in just personal information management for me. It's just a remarkable thing. People who talk about tagging services focus on a lot of other things, but I haven't really heard many people articulate this very simple and basic idea. And the difference can be illustrated in the following way. As recently as 2 years ago, if someone said, what resources do you have on X? My reply would have been, well, let me see, I'll go collect a bunch of things, I'll put them in an email, and I'll send them to you. Right? Well, so A, I've sent them only to you. B, it's immediately stale, right? Because if I find something, next week and add it to that list, right? It's not on the list that I sent you. So, this is just a remarkable twist on that maneuver, where what you say is, I'm giving you a pointer in computer science terms, right? It's a promise to the future, right? So, this thing is as alive, as active as I make it. And if you visit this URL next weekend, I've updated it in the meantime. Anyway, you get the idea. It's extremely useful. The other sense in which this stuff is then active is that you have a sense of how other people are engaging with this. So what we have here is a Delicious page for what was okay. So this is my intermediation tag in Delicious. It's intermediation plus the things that I wrote about it. Right. So it's my writings on that topic. And then what you can see is, one other person, four other people, five other people. So what I'm seeing here is a sense to which others have engaged with this material, right? So this says basically four other people also bookmarked this URL, right? Five other people also bookmarked this URL. So, you know, and then I can, of course, drill down and find out who are those people, and what interests do they share in common with me? What resources have they collected that I don't know about? So we have, you know, sort of transiently self-identifying collections of people forming around this mechanism, and that that's extremely interesting. Another this sort of illustrates also why this canonical naming, right, using the same URL as much as possible is important, right? Because again, if you know, I had one version of the article that two of those people linked to, and another version that another two linked to, then that would be, right, it wouldn't, you wouldn't coalesce in this way. I won't say much about this, but the idea, this is a kind of a concept thing, and it's actually possible to do in Microsoft Office right now, although I don't use Microsoft Office. But anyway, the idea is that a buddy list is not a flat list. It shouldn't just be a flat list, right? Like I have, you know, 300 buddies or in IAM or however many I have, right? You know, because what should be the case is that in a context, whatever that context is, the buddy list, the IAM contacts that are available to me should be sensitive to that context, right? So if, in other words, if I'm in a project context and I'm working on a set of documents in that context, well, I know who the people are who are working with me in that context. You know, why shouldn't, you know, that be my buddy list for that context, right? So anyway, that's just a that's just something to demand of your of your software vendors, because it doesn't really happen yet. So my Amazon wish list is active in the following sense. I put a book onto my Amazon wish list one day, and about a month later, it shows up in my RSS reader as available in my local library. So that's pretty cool. should I explain more about what that is? Yeah. Okay. So what happens here is a piece of software looks at my Amazon wish list, and it looks at the ISBNs that are on that wish list. And it takes each of those ISBNs and runs it through the service that I showed you that expands one to many, because it wants to look up all instances of the book, not just one. And then it takes each of those and looks it up in my local library, the Keene College and public libraries. And if it finds that the book is available, it posts essentially to a blog, right? It writes an RSS file. And so my RSS reader will just every now and then say, oh, this book that was on your Amazon wish list is in the library now. You know, it's we should expect that. We should demand that, right? It's things should work that way. This is the more dynamic version of the same idea, right? So here I'm on an Amazon page, and I turn on my I apologize for the advanced geekery here, but you'll see the point, right? I refresh the page, and hey, it's available in the Keene Library, right? So, things should work that way, and they can, but the reason that they don't work that way more is because we don't have the expectation that they should. And we don't clearly enough articulate that's what ought to be happening, right? Because I assure you the obstacles are mainly not technological. Some properties of these things, future-proofed, meaning what I said before, right? That this list that I give you is not static. It is active, and it will evolve, and it will be different in the future. Better, like what you guys were talking about earlier, in the wiki context. I mean, the same thing, right? You know, this is, it's not a finished product. It's an evolving thing. It's a moment in time, and it moves on. You know, they are hopefully delivered in a context or relevant to a context. They can be queried, and I think that you know. So, for example, the delicious case that I showed you is a kind of a database query, right? And this is kind of one of these things that I think people haven't figured out yet about these tagging services, you know, be it Delicious or Flickr or whatever, is that in a certain sense, these things are actually databases that you can use. And just by being diligent about choosing naming conventions, you can in fact construct what would be described as a database application, right? You know, I mean, you can put a set of photos up on Flickr, and just by being thoughtful about the way in which you assign tags to photographs, you can then make queries that combine those tags to do, you know, what is effectively, you know, what a database hacker would think of as a SQL join or something like that, right? And so there's a very lightweight, very accessible kind of data management that's available. And they're social, and by that I mean the kind of thing that you saw on the Delicious page where, you know, my list of things that I'm keeping track of in this topic is also engaging me with other people who are watching that same topic, and I can become aware of who those other people are, you know, and so on. And subscribable as well, and this is kind of a key thing. One of the things I noticed in the wiki presentation earlier is that I think maybe one of those wikis was available as an RSS feed, but the other is probably not, right? Like MediaWiki is generally not. Is that true?
Yeah.
It is?
No, I think it is not.
It is not. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, so that question about at one point, well, you know, people have to remember to go to the wiki, you know, to check it. That problem is mitigated, well, it goes away when the recent changes page of the wiki is an RSS feed, you know, and of course assuming that people are in fact in this mode of using an RSS reader. But if that's the case, you know, then you know, that's an incredibly powerful thing. So, you know, this library thing that I have, right? I mean, I mostly forget about it because it's not that frequent an occurrence that a book that's on my Amazon wish list becomes available at my public library. I mean, it might happen like every, you know, couple, 3, 4, 5 weeks, right? But when it happens, you know, boom, right? I'm alerted, and I didn't have to remember to go and check. So, you know, that's just a tremendously powerful thing. People have tended to think about RSS in terms of blogging as, you know, sort of this is who I read. Right, and this is how I keep track of, you know, who I read and what changes they posted. You know, but there's this whole sort of vast other dimension to RSS, which is only now emerging, which is it's also just a generalized way to be notified, right? To receive, in technical terms, to receive alerts asynchronously, right? Without having to remember to go check a bunch of different places. So, this was a very interesting book. I saw this guy on C-SPAN Book TV, and he's a Vermont physician who is a family doc for 25 years, but he's also got a background in statistical research. And he got really pissed off about the just level of corruption in you know, the sort of combination of pharmaceutical and insurance industries and what that's done to medicine. And he wrote an excellent book on the subject. And so this is part of his book, which shows, you know, that we're basically not only paying way more than everybody else, but we're getting way worse results, okay? And, you know, to his credit, he actually cited, his sources of data, right, which I thought was good. But what I rarely, if ever, see happening is, this kind of a follow-on, where I said, I'm actually curious, let me go look at that. You know, so I went and I used a different combination of the sources that he cited, and I came up with this. So it actually has us being, you know, just as insanely expensive, but not as embarrassingly bad, you know, on the results. The point really is that this is not a routine operation, and I wish that it were, right? We're in a position now where we ought to expect that we can follow these sources, right? We can do parallel analysis. We can post the results you know, and then we can have a conversation. Like, you know, because his point was really about the difference between raw life expectancy and healthy life expectancy. So, you know, what is healthy life expectancy? Well, let's talk about it, right? You know, let's get the data out there. Let's have a discussion. You know, and, you know, this guy, you know, he doesn't have a blog. He's not sort of, you know, he has a website for the book, right? But there's, you know, I mean, actually, you know, I wrote about it. I posted this. And he never noticed the fact that that was happening, right? Which is, you know, okay. I mean, but you know, my expectation is that that will change, right? My expectation is that, you know, first of all, you know, you'll not only cite your sources, you know, but you'll provide them in a way that is tractable, you know, which is, you know, maybe not necessarily an Excel spreadsheet, right? You know, but you'll provide your, the expectation will be to provide your data in a way that is consumable, you know, and then the expectation will be that other people will in fact consume it. We'll reanalyze it, right, and that there can be, you know, discussion. I mean, we can, you know, the whole model of academic discourse is now open, you know, to everyone. It's just a question of engaging in it. This is great. So this is the kind of thing I mean. Paul Kudrowski is a venture capitalist and I think a business professor, also a blogger, and he put up this you know, animation that he made of some data about, I don't know, Tiger Woods. And I thought, I mean, what I thought was cool about it was I'm also very interested in the use, you know, the degree to which we don't use animation to display changing data, right? I think that's kind of a shame. So then along comes this guy, Chris Gemignani, who's actually got a consulting company who does data visualization and analytics. And he said, oh, by the way, you know, I'm an expert in Excel. And, you know, you can do the same thing in Excel, which, who knew? I didn't know, actually. I was blown away, right? This guy can do this kind of thing in Excel. Even more wonderful, he showed us how. He showed us how to do it. So this is a little tutorial that Chris made that, if you walk through it, is a lesson in advanced Excel, right? It's a couple of minutes. I won't play the whole thing. But, you know, I learned from this how to do what he had done, and, you know, far more effectively than I could have learned it from any kind of written description. But, you know, really the aspect of, you know, let's kind of jam on different ways of doing this and then share the techniques was awesome. How many people have seen the Apple Knowledge Navigator video? Some people. I'm going to play you just a little snippet of it. This is along the lines of, you know, what we should expect. This is from a long time ago, but it's still spot on.
Your friend Jill Gilbert has published an article about deforestation in the Amazon and its effects on rainfall in the sub-Sahara. It also covers drought's effect on food production in Africa and increasing imports of food.
Contact Jill.
I'm sorry, she's not available right now. I left a message that you had called.
Okay, let's see. There's an article about 5 years ago, Dr. Flemson or something. He really disagreed with the direction of Jill's research.
John Fleming of Uppsala University. He published in the Journal of Earth Science of July 20 of 2006.
Yes, that's it. He was challenging Jill's projection of the amount of carbon dioxide being released to the atmosphere through deforestation. I'd like to recheck his figures.
Here's the rate of deforestation you predicted.
What happened? Hmm. It was really off. Give me the university research network. Show only universities with geography notes. Show Brazil. Copy the last 30 years at this location at 1 month intervals.
Excuse me. Jill Gilbert is calling back.
Great.
Well, you know, we're not there yet. But I think about this a lot, and, you know, there's sort of a couple of aspects of this. You know, one being, again, you know, we shouldn't lose sight of this expectation. And number two, you know, we need to think ourselves as producers of data and producers of information. You know, what can we do to enable these scenarios, right? It's not all on the technology to mine, the stuff out of random things that we do, right? It's also a lot to do with our own strategies and procedures and methods and behavior as we interact with information and each other online. This is a little detour into this extremely geeky thing that I've done, my weblog uses some simple tags to enable me to run effectively queries over the whole thing. So what I'm asking for here is where have I quoted Ward Cunningham, the inventor of the wiki? The enabler for this query is really just that stuff in green, right? So it's just a little piece of HTML this goes back to this question of consistent naming, right? I mean, it's a really, really hard thing to do in the sense that it requires discipline, but an easy thing to do in the sense that it requires nothing other than that discipline, right? I mean, you know, in any context where you are working with a namespace, right, a collection of names, you know, whether it's file names, whether it's titles, whether it's tags in a document, right? You know, if you just put a little bit of effort into thinking about what are the patterns that I'm applying to these names, that, because you have to, right? I mean, it actually makes it easier anyway, right? I mean, naming is hard. It's one of the hardest things, right? You always get stuck. Well, what should I call this, right? So, having conventions about how you name things is one way to make it easier, actually, to do the naming. But it's a powerful enabler for all kinds of things. This is just another example. So, I can literally go to my blog and say, show me all of the places where I wrote a fragment of Python code, right? Or show me all of the places where there are tables, right? It's just a query. Documents. The lesson of XML really is that the document is the database. The database is the document. There is not going to be any hard and fast distinction, right? You know, documents, data, it kind of all becomes the same thing. And so principles of data management that formerly were sort of relevant in the geeky database domain, you know, are now also relevant in the domain of those of us who think of ourselves as just, you know, writers. This is just a kind of a follow-on to the Wikipedia discussion of this morning. So the backstory here is that I did do this screencast that Gardner talked about on, and it was a look at the life of a page in Wikipedia. And actually, to make that screencast, I had to step through the whole change log of Wikipedia, capture all the pages, and those became frames of the movie, and then I animated that on a timeline. So a guy called Andy Bio said, well, you know, gee, it'd be really cool if Wikipedia could actually do that. Like, why can't I animate the changes of any page interactively? So he put out a call for entries, and four or five people actually did it, right? So there's this is the winner. This guy wrote a script that runs inside of Firefox that says, go to the change history for this Wikipedia page, find all the changes, and make them into a movie. So, you click animate changes, and boom, right? And he's inlined all the changes, right? So, I mean, you can see that this is radically easier to visualize than the raw change log, right? You can, you've got a slider, and you just got scroll back and forth and see what changed. I think this is another kind of an expectation that we need to bring to the technologists, right? You know, that to tell you the truth, a lot of geeks, they don't see the problem, right? Because they're programmers, and programmers live in a world where they have this tool called diff, right? That says, here's the old version of the program, here's the new version of the program. Well, of course I can look at the two things, side by side and compute the changes in my head, right? And so that's a very natural operation, most people, and even though I'm a programmer, me too, I would rather have a, more condensed and more effective way to visualize change. So it's something that we need. So this is Tim O'Reilly and Richard Stallman. And Tim is, I think, one of the best examples of somebody I would describe as a meme hacker, right? So, a meme being the Richard Dawkins sort of cultural version of a gene, right? The, you know, the idea of a viral idea that propagates. I've come to see that a lot of what Tim does is very conscious manipulation of, or creation and manipulation of memes, right? You know, in his case, I think a combination of excellent social purposes and also his own corporate interest. Those things come together. But so, for example, you know, free software didn't really work so well, right? And so they spent a lot of time, you know, trying to get that open source meme out there to resonate with people. You know, open source in turn, you know, has been morphing to architecture of participation, you know, and this one in particular, you know, I mean, Tim actually, you know, because I've sort of watched this play out, you know, he was talking about the web operating system, you know, for a couple of years, the internet operating system for a couple of years, you know, he finally settled on web 2.0, right? And, you know, it's just, I don't know, it seems kind of silly and arbitrary, but there's something critical about finding that magic key, you know, that unlocks whatever it is that it needs to unlock in people's heads. And, you know, this can be sort of a conscious operation. Let me just play you this. This is a piece of, I don't know, it's a screencast. You could call it a piece of propaganda. I don't know what you would want to call it, but it's by the ACLU. And have people seen this? How many people will have seen this? A couple. Yeah, okay.
Pizza Palace, guaranteed to have 30 minutes or it's free. This is Mary. May I take your order?
Hi, Mary. Yes, I'd like to order.
This is Mr. Kelly?
Yes.
Thank you for calling again, sir. I share your national identification number is 610-204-999-8-45-5460. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. I see you live at 736 Montrose Court, but you're calling from your cell phone. Are you at home?
I'm just leaving work, but I'm...
Oh, we can deliver to Bob's Auto Supply. That's at 175 Lincoln Avenue, yes?
No, I'm on my way home. How do you know all this stuff?
We just got wired into the system, sir.
Oh. Well, I'd like to order a couple of your double meat special pizzas.
Sure thing. There'll be a new $20 charge for those, sir.
What do you mean?
Sir, the system shows me that your medical records. Luckily, we have a new agreement with your national health care provider that allows you to sign double E-pies as long as you agree to waive all future claims of liability. You can sign the form when we deliver, but there is a charge for processing. The total is $67. That
includes
the delivery surcharge of $15 to cover the address to our driver of traveling through an orange zone.
I live in an orange zone?
Looks like there was another robbery on Montrose yesterday.
So now here's the, you know, here's my sort of backstory on this thing. The thing actually came out in, I think, July of 2004, and I got wind of it one way or another pretty soon, right? Now what this background data is, by the way, is I did some data mining against a couple of different services. So Delicious, I looked at who had posted links to this thing over time. And I did the same in, I think, blog lines, right? So it's basically, you know, looking at the level of interest in this thing over time, which in itself is pretty cool. So anyway, this is where I heard about it. And then this is my sister up here, you know, a total non-geek, who got wind of it, you know, December of 2004. And so it was interesting to me in a couple of ways. I mean, she sort of CC'd me on this email. And her comment was, while this is pretty grim, I suppose we're probably already there, though, right? Like, it's a done deal. This is just going to happen. You know, resignation, basically, was her attitude. A couple days later, Phil Windley, who's an InfoWorld contributing editor and the author of the O'Reilly Digital Identity book, blogged about it. And he blogged about it because he'd gotten it from Kim Cameron, who is the digital identity architect at Microsoft, right? And is the guy who probably has the most power on this planet right now to assure that that nightmare scenario doesn't actually play out, right? In other words, he's actually a good guy. He's fighting the good fight, and he wants to do things right. And he wants to safeguard your privacy, and he wants to do, he has written what he calls the 7 laws of identity, and he wants those things to play out, right? And the thing that occurred to me was that, the popular consciousness had already reached a conclusion long before, they've even gotten to beta with the thing that they're building, right? And my point to Kim, who I, by the way, as a result of this interaction, I eventually met, my point was, why aren't you guys seeing what people think? Like, I'm seeing what people think, number one. But number two, if you really have a vision, of how you're going to do things right instead of do things wrong, why aren't you communicating that vision in as viral a way as the ACLU did, right? I mean, why aren't you hacking out your own meme, to compete with that meme? Because, that's the way that, it's ultimately going to depend on people buying in to whatever the solution is. Right, so why wouldn't you want to build that support using communication of this form? And he agreed. I mean, it hasn't happened, but he's thinking about it. He's thinking about it. This is just another example of sort of conscious manipulation, if you will. So this word screencast, which connotes these screen movies with audio that I've been making for a couple of years. Is a word that I actually didn't invent, but what happened is people came to my blog and said, there should be a name for this thing. I said, yeah, there probably should, right? And so I actually had a little contest, and people fed me a bunch of names, and we kind of collated them all, and then I picked Screencast as the one. And this was also a conscious thing. I wanted to be able to track how that meme was propagating, and so now I can, right? That's kind of a weird thing. We're going to get all sorts of bizarre coinages now because people are going to be doing this, consciously. But this is how I see the evolution of the uptake of this term, right? How widely has this meme spread? Well, I can simply just directly measure it, in terms of Google Pages. The last topic here is the sort of multimedia stuff that I've kind of been dragged kicking and screaming into. I mean, I never was an audio video guy at all. I was always a writer, but in the last couple of years, I've just it's become apparent that these are activities that I need to be learning about, learning how to do, engaged with. So, I think the term new media is funny, because. Actually, I think print is the new medium, and I think that that sound and picture are the original ones, right? So we have a sort of an inversion here going on. Although I will say that this is a picture of the Lascaux Cave, which is one of the sources of inspiration for my wife's art, and we visited not the cave because it's closed, but we visited the simulation of the cave, and. You can see that in that environment, in a sort of a flickering candlelight situation, these things actually appeared to move, right? So you could even argue that it was like a movie. It was like video, right? These are some pictures of storytellers that I just found randomly. And the last one in the series is this guy, Alan Cooper. Alan Cooper is the guy who created the interface to Visual Basic, right? He's a software designer. And he operates in this mode that he calls ethnography, right? Where, what he does is I go into a community that needs software built for it, and I learn the stories of the people who are doing whatever people do in that community, and then I tell those stories, right? And those personas, as he calls them, are the software specification, right? It's, the story of this person's work life is the spec for the software. I find that interesting. A weird thing's been happening to me since I've been spending all this time listening to these audio talks on my headphones while I'm out riding my bicycle or running or whatever. And it makes me think that, there are actually, that there are some aspects to these media that are sort of deeply connecting us to things in our own brains and in our own history that we maybe have forgotten or aren't in close touch with. But so what this is trying to illustrate is that when I was trying to remember where Lisa made that comment that I referred Scott to in that soundbite that I showed you, I thought about it and I remembered that I'd been out on a run when I was listening to it. And I actually, and this is happening to me a lot, is that I knew where I was when I heard it, right? Like my position on the landscape correlated in my mind to the position in that audio stream. And in fact, I went to that position and roughly and found the thing, right? And actually, I think there's something kind of deep about that. I mean, it's sort of it reminds me of when you read about these people who are memory freaks, and they explain how they do what they do, and it invariably involves a kind of a storyline, right? Like, well, I tell a story, and then when I was here, I saw this object, and when I was there, right? And that and there's something about how memory works, I think, that is connected to that, and how learning happens as well. So, not sure what to do with that actually, but I just it deeply interests me, and this is a kind of a modern interpretation of it. So Jeff Hawkins is he's the guy that I guess founded Palm, but he's really his passion in life is neuroscience. He's now started this company called Numenta, which is attempting to commercialize his theory of neuroscience. And what it boils down to is that, in our brains we structure things in terms of sequences. Is the short, skinny of it, right? So we have literally stored, in our brains in the neocortex, sequences of events, right? And that's in fact why storylines, map really powerfully to our awareness. I don't know, pop neuroscience, right? But I think it's interesting. So I wrote a letter to Dear Abby recently in response to this column, which is part of what I see as a sort of a growing backlash against blogging and MySpace and Facebook and all of these things. So this guy is alerting Abby to the fact that these people who are blogging could be compromising their careers and getting themselves into all sorts of trouble. Which is true. But what worries me is that I'm just seeing all of these negative messages coming out now, and I think it's only just starting, right? That the predation on MySpace, all of this other stuff is creating a reaction, in particular in schools, in particular in at least the elementary and grade schools in my community, we have to warn kids against this stuff, right? We have to alert them to the dangers, and which is okay, but not if that's all you tell them, right? So my response is, why aren't you showing people and telling people and teaching people how to use this stuff properly? Like, what is in fact the appropriate way to be online, in the 21st century, right? Like, what is your web presence mean to you as a lifelong thing? It's something that people, I think, are not thinking about nearly enough. You might have heard about, you probably did hear about this incident. There was a big scandal on Wikipedia when this fellow, John Siegenthaler, discovered that he had been slandered on Wikipedia. He's a prominent journalist. He was, I think, the head of the American Newspaper Association, and he's got this foundation on the First Amendment. And he was implicated as being involved in the assassination of Robert Kennedy on Wikipedia. And it was up there for months, right? And he was just blown away when he found out about that. He'd actually worked for Kennedy. I mean, obviously wasn't an assassin. And so he wrote this article on USA Today that said basically, this was horrible, this happened to me, it could happen to you. Be aware of the danger, right? And, my thought was, I hope that it won't be the case for too much longer that a person like you will be invisible to the net, other than some random thing that someone put on Wikipedia, Right? In other words, you know, why weren't you the authoritative source of information about you? Right? And, you know, why wasn't it a little bit... Well, first of all, if you had been, right, then the Wikipedia page would have either A, linked to you, or B, been suspicious by the omission of that link, right? And so I think that that in general, what I hope will happen is that we'll see that blogging is actually just an extension of our identities into the online realm, you know, in a really deep and long-term way. And that... you know, that the benefits of that will be immense in a variety of ways, and that the drawbacks of it, you know, are things that, you know, we'll have to learn, and there will be slip-ups, right? There will be things that, you know, I mean, all of us at this point, I think, understand that every word that we write pretty much online is there forever, right? And will be easily discoverable, you know? So we've all got a level of transparency going on, and we're heading toward a greater level of transparency, which is thrilling but frightening. And you know, so you know, I think the real challenge here is you know, sort of from an educational point of view, to first of all get people to see that is the expectation, right? That is where we're going to be. And second of all, then how to properly manage that, right? I mean, it's not what shouldn't you present, right? But what should you present, and how should you present that, right? Are things that I think everyone needs to be taught, right? And they especially need to be taught because we're all still making it up as we go along, right? So it's not like there's a set of basic principles or best practices, right? So we have to, you know, we have to kind of go with the flow here. But you know, I think that the basic ideas are, I hope, going to be sound. So, this is the last bit. This is an interaction that happened between me and Gardner and some other people. But so it went like this. I posted something that had an interview with me, and Gardner saw it, and he posted something, and you know, then it linked to here, and then it went back to there. Right. So there was this virtual conversation happening. Blog to blog. And, you know, finally, Gardner was surprised that I had noticed the thing that he had posted, pointing to me, blah, blah, blah. I think shocked, you know, that the kind of thing that the cycle of citation and acknowledgement, you know, that might have taken, you know, weeks, months, or longer in academia was compressed, you know, was almost immediate. And, you know, that's a profound thing, and it's something that, again, it. I think people don't discover this, you know, who only read blogs. I think it's only the case that once you become a participant, and once you begin to publish out into the network, it's only then that you discover the way in which the network connects back to you, right? Because otherwise you don't experience that. So it's only sort of an imaginary kind of thing. Well, what would it be like if, you know, but the reality of, you know, anything that I've posted, right? So I've got all of these documents out there on the web right now. I've got basically, you know, from a sort of multicellular perspective, right? I've got this large surface area that's available for interaction. And anytime there is an interaction with any piece of my digital identity, if you will, that I have extruded out into this space, right? Anytime something touches that, I know it. Right, it's actually trivial because there are all these services that, you know, scan all the blogs, and anytime somebody links to something that you posted, you know it, right? So you have this extreme level of awareness, you know, but yet in a very diffuse and loosely coupled way, which is a strange and bizarre kind of thing in some ways, but I was looking for a way to sort of tie this back to, you know, the economy, actually, because I think it's a pretty important thing. This is a guy. He's a Yale law professor who's just written this book called The Wealth of Nations, which is actually freely available. Right, he's kind of a Larry Lessig character. Right, he's a law professor actually, but he's you know a very strong advocate of you know, sort of commons-based peer production is the term. Right, this notion that you know, we've been for several generations now a society of largely consumers, right? And you know, we mostly don't think of ourselves as producers, And you know, he's very seriously looking into what, you know, what will it mean, right? What will it mean to our society, to our economy, when the production of culture and the production of economic value is in fact radically decentralized. And one of the enablers for this is this idea of loose association. You know, that, you know, I didn't need to have an interaction with Gardner. I didn't need to, you know, sign up to a discussion service somewhere. I didn't need to, you know, log in to his blog, and he didn't need to log into my blog, right? That loose coupling was affected by the network, right? And by the awareness of parts of the network, of, you know, to other parts of the network. So, you know, he makes the point that, you know, it's not just that with all of these tools that we have now, we can do more as individuals, right? We have just greater reach and power individually, but it's that we can do more in loose association with other people. And, you know, the critical thing that I hadn't really thought about is that these kinds of collective action historically have required relatively expensive and durable social structures, right? Be it employment, be it family or local community, right? So we've never had before the possibility for a group of people to come together around some task or some project in a transient way, create value, you know, and then, you know, remain associated or not remain associated, you know, at their leisure, right? So, you know, his argument, and I think he's totally right, is that this is a profound new capacity depends on our ability to sort of inhabit the online world with the awareness of the possibility and the openness to participating in those kinds of ad hoc arrangements. So I should stop there. But do you want to have discussion or?
Yeah, let's take a few minutes for some questions, and then there will be a panel discussion a little later this afternoon. We'll have time for even more discussion. But if you have a couple of questions for John right now, please. Or is this something you want to mull over, say, over lunch or for the rest of your lives? Go ahead.
Well, what kind of running through my mind at the risk of making the library staff insufferable is that a lot of the kind of data management and organization you're talking about with tagging, naming, that you're using your journalistic metaphor, in fact, is the great demon of all library science, the cataloger. And maybe it could be that computer programming could learn an awful lot from the very elaborate system of library cataloging, so that when I go to Project Muse and I want X article at this time and this time frame and I can't remember what it was, it pops up. And I'm just thinking as a fogey in terms of this kind of...
No, it's absolutely true that that library science is a radically underappreciated discipline.
Jeff.
But it's true. You're absolutely right. You know, the question, the experiment that's being conducted right now is, can cataloging be done in a collective way? And it's not, you know, a slam dunk, right? I mean, the results that you get are going to be scattered, right? They're going to be, in fact, probabilistic, right? You know, this many people chose to categorize the thing this way. That many people chose to categorize it that way, right? Is that a bad thing, though? Right? It's. You know what I mean? Here's a good example. A friend of mine gave a talk on this sort of new ontology stuff, tagging stuff, right? And he said, so if you go to Delicious, you'll find a bunch of people who tag as cinema, other people tag as film, other people tag as movies, you know. And what that actually says, he argues, is that, well, because the people who tag as film, they don't want to hang out with the people who tag as movies, right? They actually self-identify as communities within that space, right? So it actually, you know, it's not simple, but
no, not at all.
But I agree. You know, we're librarians.
I just think about what would happen with this science fiction movie. You know, the cataloger and the programmer.
Yeah.
More of an idea of novel in my future.
Yeah.
It was interesting to me listening that you're original background was writing, and I've been listening to use of metaphors, and it's been really fantastic for me, because a lot of tech lectures that I'll sit into, a person doesn't necessarily have the same relationship with language, and they have a very difficult time, sort of, and metaphor is sort of the foundation. So I just wanted to say that's been a really exciting experience. But what I wanted to ask is, you have a very, I think, progressive view of how these things can be deployed, and about, what, 10%, would you say, of the whole globe has access? So I wanted to sort of address, what does that mean in terms of all this, or what are some of the ideas out there? Because we talk about we, but it's a really tiny part of the whole, you know, species.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what does that mean, or what are some of the thoughts out there about that?
Well, I guess that, you know, the good news is that, you know, I'm not anymore tied to a desktop computer, right? I pretty much live in the cloud, and I pretty much, you know, I could do much of what I need to do on a $100 PC. Right. So this I think it's who's doing the $100 PC project right now?
Is it MIT?
Yeah, right. So you know, that the goodness of Web 2.0 is a lot about the fact that, you know, it's no longer necessarily a big, expensive, clunky device, right? You know, that something extremely simple and lightweight can do, you know, well, not the AV functions, right? But everything else, which is a huge amount of the value, right? And so that's one. And two is that, you know, in most of the third world, you know, they're just going to leapfrog the wires. There'll never be a wired network, and there will never need to be one, right? It'll go straight to wireless. You know, so you know, those are two hopeful prospects, anyway. But you're right. I mean, there's, you know, vast numbers of people who have never made a phone call, never mind sent an email message.
Yeah,
so
that would be a huge jump. That would be fascinating.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Well, another issue that, you know, because of course all of these, you know, sounds fantastic, but when it comes to time management, it involves a lot of multitasking, and, you know, especially, you know, since a lot of us are professors here, we are tied down to a lot of other things, and, you know, there's more and more that is asked,
right.
You know, you do this and that, but, you know, you have students, you know, emails, you have this,
yeah.
You have preparation, you have, you know, publishing for academic journals, and
right.
At the same time, even if you want to be part of this, something has to go, because there's no way you can fit in everything.
Well, here's a way to think about it. I have a corollary to the principle of time conservation that I call the principle of keystroke conservation. Right. I actually came to this because the principle of keystroke conservation, right? Which I came to because I was typing way too much, right? I mean, I actually kind of wore out the warranty on my wrist tendons a few years ago. So, but a way that I encourage people to think about this is that every act of communication, you know, and I'm typing because that is kind of like my primary mode. Maybe it is yours, right? A lot of writing, you know, has a potentially wider audience than the target that you identify. So, for example, email to and from students. You know, in how many cases is the message that was targeted at one individual student potentially appropriate to many? Right? If the message that was intended to go to that student is also appropriate to many, then it's no more effort to locate that message in a shared space, right? To which the many are subscribed, right?
It similarly, the message.
Similarly, you know, a publication. You know, to the extent that the drafts, let's say, of a publication that you're working on in collaboration with other people, to the extent that those are shareable, working on them in a shared space is going to mean less mechanical, logistical effort in managing a bunch of emails, right? I mean, there's, you know, there's this notion of moving stuff into shared spaces and then thinking about what scope is of those shared spaces, right? Is it my immediate circle of colleagues, right? Is it, you know, the whole department? Is it the whole university? Is it the whole world? Is it this interest group that I belong to, right? I mean, you know, what I try to do is push things out always to the widest possible scope that's appropriate. And often it turns out that's pretty wide, right? And there's not, it depends what you do, but there's not a whole lot that I do that's incredibly confidential. Right, so I'm always seeking to maximize the opportunities for collaboration, right? But I'm not doing more typing. I'm not doing more stuff. I'm just rearranging where I publish it. Does that make any sense?
Oh, it makes sense from your perspective, not from mine.
but I'd be interested to know.
No, because I mean, you have very specific things that you do, and you know, and I keep hearing you students complaining. They say, you know, I mean, I have this professor who is, you know, who is blogging like, you know, like this, and yet, you know, it's very hard to get to. I can't get the response from. So to me, there is a fault. You know, I mean, I have heard it from students. I'm not, you know, making that up.
Yeah.
And, you know, so to me, there's something to be said about, you know, because, of course, you can never overextend yourself. I mean, this is exciting, this is great,
right.
And you want to reach out, but you also have certain commitments, and it's very difficult to manage these commitments.
Well, here's another thought I've had, and, you know, you'll just have to shout me down if this is totally off the wall, but it has occurred to me, one of the things I've been listening to now a lot is... lectures, right? I'm actually taking a biology course through Berkeley because it's, you know, the MP3s are online, and I actually was a really good student of biology a long time ago, and I'm refreshing my understanding of population genetics. I'm listening to this guy, and he's talking to a room full of Berkeley undergrads, right? And it's a lecture, and I'm thinking, well, you know, if I can absorb this lecture while I'm out on my bike, you know, what would be a better use of that hour of the guy's time? Like, what if we all had heard the lecture, and then we came in, and the face-to-face time was about a focused interaction, which was informed by, you know, the information that was transmitted, you know, through the podcast, right? So, you know, again, it'd be like the one-to-many, you know, you've optimized for that case, and now, you know, because that's really what I want, right? What I really want to do now is I've heard the lecture, you know, it made me think of this and this. You know, I want to have a discussion about that, and it would be good if the rest of the class could benefit from that discussion, and vice versa in terms of their stuff, right? Is that conceivable?
Well, if this were a movie, we'd call it a cliffhanger.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Sorry.
But episode 2 is on the way, and it's much better than the episode 2 that George Lucas made.
Yeah.
You've been listening to 21st Century Literacy, the keynote address from the 2006 Faculty Academy on Instructional Technologies, presented by John Udell. For more information about Faculty Academy, visit our website at facultyacademy.org. Thanks for listening.